Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Everyone, welcome back to another episode of Talking Tudors. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger. Thank you so much for joining me today. I'd like to start by introducing you to these bloody days, the fall of Anne Boleyn. I'm thrilled that Dr. Owen Emerson and I have teamed up to bring you a week-long online event exploring Anne Boleyn's downfall, beginning on Monday, 13th of May 2024. Through a series of six pre-recorded lectures and one live Zoom discussion, we'll delve deep into one of the most brutal and shocking events of Henry VIII's reign. We'll examine the courtship of Anne Boleyn and Henry VIII, the Great Matter and Anne's rise to the throne. We'll look at how Anne and Henry's relationship evolved once they were married and chart the main events of 1535 and 1536. We'll delve into the arrest, trial, and execution of an anointed queen and look at what took place in the aftermath of Anne's tragic fall. Participants will be entered into a special giveaway and have access to all recordings for 2 months after the event ends. Registrants will also get to spend part of the anniversary of Anne Boleyn's execution virtually with Owen and I. For lecture outlines and to reserve your place, just Google These Bloody Days, The Fall of Anne Boleyn, Eventbrite. I really do hope you'll consider joining us. I'd also, of course, like to acknowledge and thank the wonderful listeners who continue to support Talking Tudors on Patreon, and extend a heartfelt thank you to everyone who's taken the time to rate and review the show. As an independent podcaster, this really does mean a lot to me. If you love the podcast and you never miss an episode, I invite you to join the Talking Tudors patron family. Please visit patreon.com/talkingtudors for more information. When you join the patron family, you'll instantly unlock access to exclusive posts, including audio releases and videos. Patrons are also eligible to attend additional monthly live talks and take part in a member-only book club. They can also enter patron-only monthly giveaways, to name but a few of the perks. You can also support the podcast and share your love of Tudor history with the world by buying Talking Tudors merchandise. There are a number of designs and products available, including phone cases, mugs, notebooks, and apparel. Check out all the products at talkingtudors.threadless.com. Now, on to today's episode. I'm thrilled that joining me on the podcast to talk about Anne Boleyn's Psalter is Sophie Backus-Waterman. Sophie is a recent graduate of the School of Advanced Study, where she completed her dissertation on the Psalter of Anne Boleyn. She currently works as the Special Collections Photographer at St. John's College Library in Oxford, digitising many of the library's manuscripts and early printed books. She has written for the website The Anne Boleyn Files and will be presenting her research findings on the Psalter of Anne Boleyn at the annual Kings and Queens Conference in May 2024. Let's dive straight into our conversation. Welcome to Talking Tudors, Sophie. How are you?
Hello, Natalie. I'm very well, thank you. Very excited to be here.
Yes, I'm so excited to chat to you about your wonderful research. But before we dive in, of course, could you please just introduce yourself to our listeners and just tell us a little bit about you and your background?
My name's Sophie Backus-Waterman. I work as a special collections photographer at St. John's College in Oxford. I grew up in Tunbridge Wells in Kent, very near Hever Castle. And I'm a recent graduate of the University of London, where I completed a master's in book history. And my dissertation research is what we're going to talk about today.
So before we dive in and talk specifically about your research, which is about Anne Boleyn's Psalter, can you tell us why you felt the need or you became inspired to study this particular artifact?
Yeah, of course. So originally it was inspired by Kate McCaffrey's research into the hidden inscriptions in Anne Boleyn's Book of Hours. That research was published around the time that I was just about to start my dissertation. And I was amazed that manuscripts, that books owned by somebody as famous as Anne could still hold these secrets, could still be, even after all these centuries, revealing things about their owner or people who interacted with her. I just thought that was amazing. And so I looked into books that were owned by Anne and found the Psalter. And what I noticed across all of the secondary sources that discuss it is that there was a real lack of information about it. Everyone repeated the same very brief points, that it was made in Rouen, they dated it, and then that was it really. And I thought, there's got to be more to say about this artifact than what I can find in secondary sources. I wonder if they'll let me take a look. And I really thought, they're probably not going to, but I'll get in touch anyway. So the Anne Psalter is held at Wormsley Library, which is in Buckinghamshire, and it's not far from where I live. I got in touch with them and I said, you know, I'm about to undertake my dissertation research. Would you mind letting me take a look at this item? They got back in touch with me very quickly and said, yeah, sure. You know, we're open on, I believe it was Thursdays. You know, what would you like to do? And I said, well, I'm not really sure yet. I just want to kind of come and take a look and see, you know, if I can find something to say. So went along to Wormsley Library and got to see and handle this incredible artifact. And it's still, you know, such a privilege to have had that opportunity.
Could you tell all our listeners what a Psalter actually is and how people in the 16th century used it?
Yeah, of course. So a Psalter is a book of Psalms, and Anne's Psalter is divided across the liturgical hours. So at certain points of the day, she would have used it to read through the Psalms at those different various points, very similar to a book of hours, which was a prayer book. And this could be done as an individual or as a group. You could read the Psalms, reflect on them. And that was kind of the purpose of a Psalter. Sometimes they were bound with books of hours. So you would have what was called the Psalter hours, which was both. But in Anne's case, this particular manuscript is just a Psalter.
Wonderful. Now, you've talked a little bit about, well, you've told us where it's housed and a little bit about what it contains, but do you want to maybe go into a little bit more detail about what it looks like and what you saw in there when you were handling it?
It's beautiful, firstly. I was so struck going into Wormsley Library and seeing this item on the table and just basically being left to sit with it and study it. So it's bound in a later binding. Unfortunately, we don't have the original binding, and not quite sure why, whether perhaps the original binding was in particularly poor condition at the time it was rebound, or if somebody made that personal choice. But it's bound in a 17th century embroidered binding. On the front and back covers, there is the pelican in her piety, which is a Christian symbol of a pelican plucking at its breast and feeding its young with the blood coming from that. So it was a medieval idea that pelicans would feed their young in that way. And it was a symbol of Christ. So that's on the front and back covers. And it's also decorated with lots of little sequins of flowers. Yep, so that's the binding. And then in terms of the contents, when you open it, the first full page, we've got two full page illuminations. And the first full page illumination is Anne's heraldry on a diamond shaped lozenge. And that's being held up by two putti, or cherubs as we would think of them, two little red winged figures are holding up this lozenge, standing on a small grassy hill. And then you've got the main text, which is written in a humanistic script, which was a very sort of easy to read script. And if listeners want to see something similar, it's the same script that's used in Henry VIII's Psalter, which is images of it are available online. And then about halfway through a folio 209V, there is a second four page illumination, which is another lozenge. This one is grey and brown, and it depicts a monogram of Henry and Anne's initials. And a similar monogram can be seen on the King's College choir screen in Cambridge. And this was the letters H-E-R-N-X-S-L with the letter A above it. And this was an intertwining of Anne and Henry's initials. And then also on that lozenge, there is a small black Lion of Rochford charge bottom, which was a symbol that Anne adopted after her father became Viscount Rochford. And that lozenge is held up by two, this time unwinged putti, standing there on either side, holding it up.
And so do you want to tell us a little bit more about the decoration that it has and the heraldry? Because I think that reveals quite a lot, doesn't it, about its particular owner and its provenance?
Yeah, it does. So the heraldry immediately marks it out as something that was owned by Anne. It's really how we know, because unfortunately, unlike some of Anne's other books, there's no inscriptions. It's really through the heraldry that you can identify it as something that was owned by Anne. So the just to describe the first full page illumination that you see in the, if anyone isn't familiar with Anne's heraldry at this point. So in the top left lozenge, there's what's called the chief indented azure, which was the heraldry of the butlers. In the top right, you've got three gold lion's passant guardant, which was the heraldry of Thomas of Brotherton, who was the fifth son of Edward I, from whom Anne was descended. And then in the bottom left, you've got that same black lion rampant sable, which is crowned. And that was the Rochford badge, as I said. And in the bottom right, you've got the Warren Checkey or and Azure, which showed Anne's descent from the Earls of Surrey. And this heraldry was really included to show Anne's very impressive lineage. It's very commonly thought that Anne came from nothing. And I think, you know, recent scholarship is really sort of changing that, challenging that idea. And this heraldry was there designed to display that lineage and show this impressive descent, especially at the point that the manuscript was commissioned, which I think we'll talk a bit about in a minute. Throughout the contents of the manuscript itself, the divine offices, so the liturgical hours, are divided clearly with smaller initials. So inside those initials, you've got Anne's heraldry, which is the same heraldry as the one on the lozenge, or you've got the monogrammed lozenge with the intertwining of Anne and Henry's initials, and that's used to divide the hours of Vespers. And then the other offices, so Matins, Lords, and the Minor Hours, are used, divided by Anne's heraldry.
Wonderful. And do you know anything about where the book went after Anne's downfall and how it ends up in the Wormsley Library?
Yeah, so we know frustratingly little about its early provenance because there are no inscriptions. There really is just a gap. There's a gap of several centuries. Mm-hmm. And then it turned up for sale in Paris at the Library La Danchette in 1976. And I'll take now to apologise for any of my French pronunciations, which will probably be wildly off. But yeah, so it turns up for sale, sent to sale by an anonymous donor in Paris, and that was in 1976. And then it was later sold in, the next time it turns up, it's 1982, when it was sold by Sotheby's. And then it was bought by Maggs Brothers and put into the collection at Wormsley Library, where it's been ever since. When I started out on my dissertation research, I very confidently thought, I'm going to fill that gap of provenance. I'm going to find out who had it. There's nothing. Because of its embroidered binding, I have a personal theory that it was owned by perhaps a woman, because the embroidered binding and that particular symbol are so heavily sort of associated with female ownership. It's a personal theory that maybe about 100 years after, when it was rebound, it was in the possession of a woman at that point. But that's just a theory. Besides that, unfortunately, there's a gap.
Something may turn up at some point. Yeah. These things do happen. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit now about who you think created it and when roughly this was made.
Yes. So I'm going to actually speak about the work of Susan E. James, Dr. Susan James, who has recently suggested that it was the work of the Horenbaut Family Workshop. So it's always been associated with the Master of the Ango Hours because of its particular art style, the way that the putti look and the sort of particular colours that he used. It's always thought to be Master of the Ango Hours. However, Susan James has recently suggested that it was actually created by the Horenbaut Family Workshop, who also created a couple of other of Anne's manuscripts.
And so roughly when do you think that may have taken place?
Yes. So because of the heraldry that's included, it's always been dated to between December 1529 and September 1532. And that is because that was when Anne was using that particular heraldry. So that was after her father was created Viscount Rochford, but before Anne was elevated to the position of Marchioness of Pembroke, which was in September 1532. So that's the widest possible window that we have for when this manuscript was created.
And before we talk a little bit about who you think may have commissioned this book, which is, the, I suppose, a really exciting part of your research, can you tell us a little bit about the practice of gifting books in the 16th century, and particularly at the Tudor court?
Yeah, of course. So books were very personal gifts during Henry's reign, especially. So if you commissioned a manuscript that was personal for some reason. Perhaps it included a dedication or decorations, or it had personalized binding, or it was particularly about a subject that the recipient was interested in. It made for, just like today really, a very personal gift of a book. So Anne was gifted several manuscripts during her lifetime. We've got a presentation copy of a poem by Clement Moreau, which included her heraldry in its decoration as well. A treatise on letter writing by Louis de Brun. So they were the manuscripts that were made for Anne, but books could also be bequeathed. So as you probably know, Natalie, and as a lot of the listeners know, there were several books claiming to be the book that was given to Anne's ladies when she was on the scaffold. And as Kate McCaffrey's research has recently shown, one of Anne's books of hours ended up in the hands of Kentish gentry women. And then you've got a French music book that was owned by Anne, and she was given to her by Marguerite de Navarre, Francis's sister, Francis I's sister, King of France, when Anne was in France during her youth.
So up until this point, who have historians put forward or suggested as possible commissioners of this Psalter for Anne?
Yeah, so there have been three suggested commissioners since it first went to sale in 1976. Jean du Bellay, who was the French ambassador at the Henrician court from 1527 to 1534, was suggested by Christopher de Hamel when he wrote the Sotheby's sale catalogue in 1982. So in that catalogue entry, de Hamel suggests that it was the scholar Jacques Collin who was involved in the Psalter's production. But this was kind of questioned by Eric Ives when he wrote his famous biography on Anne. And there's no real link between Collin and the production of the Psalter. But then Eric Ives put forward Henry VIII, due to the personalised decoration, he made a case for the fact that the Psalter includes very personalised decoration, which could only have been included by somebody who was particularly close to Anne. And then you've got Roger S. Week, who wrote the Wormsley Library catalogue, and he suggested that it was commissioned by Thomas Boleyn, Anne's father, again, because of that closeness of the decoration.
And so in your research, who do you think possibly or potentially commissioned this particular work for Anne? And importantly, why do you think?
So going into this, I essentially put forward the theory that the manuscript was commissioned by Anne's brother, George. That was what my dissertation research was around. Professor James Carley's research in the 1990s has really shaped how we understand George's book gifting practices. And so we know that George gifted Anne two other manuscripts. The first was Epistles and Gospels, which is now in the British Library as Harley MS 6561. And this was given to Anne upon her elevation to Marchioness of Pembroke. And then you've got the Ecclesiastes, which is now Percy MS 465 at Alnwick Castle. And this was given to Anne sometime during her queenship, possibly to celebrate her coronation. And so George had, as we know from those two surviving items, a practice of giving Anne books, particularly books with an evangelical French leaning, translations as Anne's Psalter was, and particularly beautifully illuminated ones as Anne's Psalter is. So when I was first thinking about what my dissertation topic was going to be around this Psalter, I was quite simply looking at a picture of the Psalter and its inclusion of the heraldry, and I was looking at Harley, the Harley 6561 in British Library. And I noticed that both used very similar hierarchy of decoration. So what that means is both had very similar decorative initials. They both had large initial with Anne's heraldry inside it. And it was quite simply that similarity that led me to think, I wonder if it was George Boleyn who commissioned this manuscript for Anne. As we know from the other commissioners that have been put forward, it would have had to have been somebody who was close to Anne. It would have had to have been somebody who had the means, so the funds, to commission a manuscript like this, which was particularly highly decorated. There's lots of gold leaf throughout Anne's manuscript. There's lots of very bright colours, possibly lapis lazuli, which would have been used for the dark blue colours that we see throughout Anne's Psalter. And so those two possibilities together really set me on this path of seeing if I could uncover any more evidence to suggest that it was George who commissioned this manuscript for Anne. And I think it's very important to think about why he might have done this, as you said. So with the two other manuscripts that we know George gave Anne, they were both around subjects that were very close to Anne's heart. So with Harley 6561, the Epistles and Gospels, this was a text that was written by Jacques Lefebvre de Tarpes, who was an evangelical scholar, and it was translated into English and French by George. and it discusses making the gospel available to the laity. And then with Percy MS 465, which is the Ecclesiastes, this was a translation of the Bible into French, also by Lefebvre. And this was a biblical vernacular translation with commentary by the evangelical theologian Johannes Brent. And so both of those manuscripts were linked with the French evangelical movement, which both Anne and George were very interested in and involved with. The Psalter is a French translation of Psalterium ex Hebraico, which was a Latin translation of the Psalms by Felix Pratensis, which was published in Venice in 1515. So like the other two manuscripts that George gifted to Anne, it has that French evangelical lead. This was a translation of the Bible, a translation of the Psalms in the vernacular, which allowed Anne to read it in a language that she preferred reading in, which was French. And this would have been a radical way to read the Psalms at this point. So if you take all of those pieces of evidence, put them together, the strongest commissioner, I believe, would have been George.
Yes, I think he's a very strong candidate. It certainly makes perfect sense, the arguments you've put forward. It would be really great to hear a little bit more about Anne and George's interest in French evangelical manuscripts that you've already alluded to in your previous response.
Yeah, of course. So Professor James Carley really was pivotal in this research and bringing this to the fore. Anne and George were involved in a program of elevation and decoration for printed French evangelical books. So what they would do is, when George was in France on his diplomatic missions, bring these printed books back over to England, and then they would be used as the source texts for manuscripts. They would be elevated into manuscript form, because making manuscript was more personal and it's more costly, more time consuming, and these printed books really didn't serve the image that Anne was trying to project of majesty and evangelical piety. So the printed books would be copied out into manuscript form. And we know that Anne and George had, as I say, three of these. So you've got Harley and Percy, and then you've got the Psalter as well. And part of my research was really uncovering a stemma for the Psalter, so uncovering its trajectory from printed book to manuscript. And this actually allows us to redate the Psalter. So as I said earlier, it's always been dated from between 1529 to 1532. However, if we follow the trajectory of printed book to manuscript, then the printed book that was the source text for Anne's Psalter was published in 1531 by Martin Lemperer in Antwerp. So that narrows the commissioning date of the Psalter from 1529 to a later date of 1531 at the earliest. These French evangelical manuscripts were, as I said, used to project this image that Anne wanted to impart, the image of a scholarly woman who was interested in these beautiful, costly manuscripts, which advertised her lineage through the heraldry, through this very impressive bindings. And they really helped to project this image that she wanted to project at this point, especially if we're talking about that window, 1531 to 1532, when she really was a queen in waiting.
Yes, that was a crucial period in her story, definitely. So you've talked about a few of these wonderful manuscripts that still survive. Are there any other books that belong to Anne or George that we still have?
Yes, so we have 9 books that we know personally belong to Anne, and because they include her inscriptions or her heraldry. And then we've got 2 books that we know belong to George, because they include his inscriptions. But I think what's really key for the particular case that I've put forward with Anne Psalter was that Anne and George amassed a collection of around 40 evangelical French books, or books published by French evangelical printers. So they were part of the Royal Library collection, and they were sequestered when Anne and George were arrested. And that's how we still have them today. A lot of them still are held within the British Library. And it was through James Carley's work that a lot of them were discovered, and that a lot of the library was reconstructed. And I think that it's particularly important when we think about the active involvement that Anne and George had in gathering these French evangelical books. It's been suggested that their effort to commission and create these French evangelical illuminated manuscripts was out of a desire to emulate the library of Marguerite de Navarre, the sister to Francis I, King of France, who both Anne and George would have known. So something that's particularly interesting when you look at the 3 manuscripts, the 2 that we know George gave to Anne and the 1 that I've posited George gave to Anne, all three of them have links to the circle of Marguerite de Navarre. So the source texts for Harley and Percy were published by Simon Dubois, the French evangelical printer. And the translation of Anne's Psalter has been linked to Louis de Brun, the scholar and translator, who, and both Simon Dubois and Louis de Brun were within the circle of Marguerite de Navarre. They were both protected by her patronage. And in 1529, when Louis de Brun was sentenced to death, Marguerite tried to use her position of power to protect him from being burnt at the stake. It didn't work. He was ultimately executed for heresy. But I think that it's particularly telling when you look, it's not just through their physical aspects of Harley, Percy, and the Psalter that they can be linked to George. It's also through that circle of Marguerite de Navarre and through the connection between George and Marguerite and Anne. It's kind of like a triangle where all of three of these manuscripts can be linked to all three of these people through their production.
Such fascinating research, Sophie. Are you going to continue looking into this, or are you going to move to another topic?
Yes, so definitely going to continue looking into this. There's a lot of things that I didn't have the space to put in my dissertation research. I tried to, and I was told that it was too off topic, right, or to really stick to what I was writing about. So I mentioned briefly earlier that I think that the manuscript may have been owned by a woman. So I'm currently undertaking research into its binding and possibly trying to put a hypothetical case together for the possibility that it was in the hands of a woman about 100 years after Anne's death in the 17th century when it was rebound. So that's one aspect. I'm also looking into the hierarchy of decoration as well. So I think that there could be a case put forward for the reason why certain initials were put where they were. So you've got, obviously, they were used to divide the divine offices, but then you've got Anne's heraldry, which was used for matins, lords, and the minor hours, and then you've got the monogram lozenges, which were used for vespers. So vespers was at the end of the day, and the idea that the monogram lozenges, which symbolized Anne and Henry's marriage, perhaps at this point you could read it as end of the day, Anne and Henry's marriage being inevitable, and then you've got the heraldry, which was used at matins, also the minor hours throughout the day. The idea that Anne's rise to queenship was sort of on the horizon, was inevitable. I think it's, maybe it's not a strong case, and I was told to leave it out of my dissertation, but it's something that I'd like to explore a little bit more. I think there, I believe, was probably some logic around the decoration, the program of decoration where they were.
Fascinating. And I'm sure that many of our listeners now want to follow your research and your work. Is there anywhere that they can follow online? Perhaps do you have a website, a blog?
Yes. So the best place to reach me would be Twitter. That's at Sophie B. Waterman X, I think I'm supposed to call it now.
Yes, of course. Lovely. Well, I'll add a link to that to our show notes so people can find you really easily. But I can't let you go just yet. There's one more thing we do on episodes of Talking Tudors when I first have my guests on, and that's what I call a little game of 10 to go. So these are just 10 questions just to get to know you a little bit better. So the first one is, what is a historic site close to home that you enjoy visiting?
Yes, so I live quite near Oxford Castle and Prison, and that is an incredible place to go and visit.
Wonderful. And what's a book that you've gone back to and read more than once?
Does it have to be history?
No, anything.
Off the top of my head, The Rise and Fall of Adam and Eve by Stephen Greenblatt is one that I go back to constantly. It's a fascinating look at that story from Genesis that we all know inside and out, and it covers the story from its earliest roots all the way up to the present day, and kind of changes of understanding of how the story was read and understood throughout its very long life. It's a fascinating read.
And what about a new skill or a new hobby that you might like to learn?
I've always wanted to learn how to sew. I can sew a button onto an item of clothing. I can sew a hole up, but that's about it. I think, learning to sew, learning to make clothes would be something that I'd love to be able to do one day.
And what do you like to do to relax after you've done all your research and work?
So I'm ashamed to say that I watch an awful lot of TV, a lot of Netflix, and also I love to read in my spare time. My bookshelves are too full of books. I should probably have a clear out at some point because I have so many.
Don't worry, I suffer from the exact same condition. So in regards to the TV that you like to watch, what's the last film or TV series that you watched?
So I'm currently watching The Apprentice as it's airing weekly with Alan Sugar and all of that reality TV sort of mindless nonsense that airs once a week.
Yeah, it's a good way to switch off, I think, with those things. And I don't know if you have an actual official bucket list, but what's something that you might like to achieve in the near future?
Yeah, so I've always wanted to travel around America. I went for the first time to visit my best friend last year, and she lives in New York. So I'd always like to travel around a little bit more and see more of that country, because I think it's very different to where I grew up and where I live now.
And in terms of seasons, do you have a favourite season and why?
Definitely summer, just because I like it being lighter in the mornings, lighter in the evenings, the days are longer, the sunshine, the warmth, people seem to be, you know, happier than when it's dark and grey and in the winter.
And you're obviously very interested in the Tudor period. Are there other periods of history that you feel drawn to?
Yes, so I always feel like I need to know a little bit more about slightly before the Tudors. I've recently gotten very interested in the Wars of the Roses and the just before the reign of Henry VII. And then also the Victorian period as well is a very interesting time to me, because I think that it's similar enough to how we live now, but just different, just out of reach, I think, in a similar way to the Tudors, actually, where you can really visualise and imagine how people would have lived.
Wonderful. And what does an ideal Sunday morning look like for you?
Oh, I'm definitely not a morning person. So a slow waking up, eventually moving from bed to the sofa, having some breakfast and just watching perhaps some YouTube or watching some TV and not needing to go anywhere or do anything, and just taking the time to relax and rest.
As an introvert, I like that. That sounds perfect. And final question, who is a person, and it might be it, contemporary person or someone from history, who inspires you?
Yes, so I'm very inspired by my dad. He, growing up, when I was growing up, he was in the police, and he always used to tell us stories about how that was for him that time there. And I think that he's a particularly strong person who has faced some adversity in his life, and I always want to try and make him proud. And he's very proud of the research I'm doing, the work I'm doing at the moment. So definitely my dad is a massive inspiration. As cliche as that sounds, it's true.
No, that's so lovely. That's really lovely. And the very last question, I promise, and I'll let you get on with your day, is our Tudor takeaway. Yeah. So something for our listeners to go off and explore after the episode.
Yeah, of course. So I would strongly recommend reading the books of King Henry VIII and his wives by Professor James Carley. That was massively influential and inspirational for my research. It was a huge help, and Professor Carley himself was very lovely and very forthcoming when I got in touch with him about my research. So if anyone hasn't read it, I really would recommend it.
That's a wonderful suggestion. Thank you so much. And thank you so much, Sophie, for taking the time to come onto the podcast and talk to Tudors with me.
No worries. It was lovely. I'm glad to have had the opportunity. Thank you very much.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for joining us. I absolutely love to hear from listeners, so if you have any comments or suggestions, or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family, and don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. You'll also find me on Twitter. My handle is On The Tudor Trail, and on Instagram as The Most Happy 78. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.